But he says, you know, look, I can prove to you, says brother, you know, that maybe Ola is not as important as the Chatas of the Yashim. What way is it not as important? He says, because the Ola, he says, you know, as far as Sefer Vayikra is concerned, you know, you have to recognize that there are two different types of Ola. Okay? He's not talking now about what we called, as I pointed out, I think, last week, Olas Tzibor. In other words, the burnt offering which is offered on behalf of the entire community of the people of Israel. Those are regulated by the Torah for Shabbos, for Rosh Chodesh, the Yontif, the various Simtavim, and you know, how many sacrifices you have to have. This goes according to whatever the Torah says. Like, for example, every day, first of all, to begin with, you have a daily sacrifice, right? Sakeva Sakho Tasiva Boker, right? In the morning there's a burnt offering of a lamb, right? Sakeva Sashin Tasiva Boim. And then in the afternoon, again, you have to have it. And, you know, this has to be Olas Tomid. It's a
continual. Yeah.
So every day in the year. Yeah. But on Shabbos, you know, there are additional sacrifices that are offered up. And this is why the word for additional in this particular is the word Musaf.
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 Yeah, right. Additional service.
Right.
Yeah.
So these are the Musafim of Shabbos and Yom Tov, uh-huh. And so on.
They don't really offer them on Shabbos, do they? They do it on Friday? I mean,
No. They were offered on Shabbos. Well, the rule was...
The fire was going all the time.
Right, oh, the fire right. was going all the time.
The Beis HaMikdash, the ordinary rules that would apply, do not necessarily apply. Where something is what we would call chova, in other words, the Torah has placed an obligation that this and this has to be done, then in that particular case, the Beis HaMikdash had overrode. Where the Torah did not indicate that this is a chova, then in that particular case, the Shabbos could not be violated. Preparations have to be done before Shabbos.
Sure.
Okay?
But they quietly didn't violate it by keeping the fire going in.
Even on Shabbos, they had to add firewood if necessary because there were sacrifices. However, the difference between Shabbos and other days is that on Shabbos, they offered up only what the Torah had prescribed for the entire community. They did not offer any private sacrifices on Shabbos, okay? On Yom Tov, it all depends what it was. Okay. If it was the Shalosh Regalim, in other words, the three pilgrimage festivals, then in that case, people would bring additional sacrifices, some of which were, burnt in their entirety, what they call Shalmei Tzibur, and then others were, the person who brought it had a festive meal with it. You know, like analogous, let's say, to the Korban Pesach. Korban Pesach had to be roasted and so on, but, again, I mean, the Korban Pesach was eaten by the people who had brought it. It could be a family, it could be two families, it could have five families joined together. But, you know, they designated, you know, that this was to be the Korban Pesach for this group. They become what they call a chabura. That's where you have this term used, but that was first used in reference, you know, to Korban Pesach and the Gemara, right? So they were members of the chabura, and they had to eat it. So that, even if it were Friday night, you understand, they still had to eat the Korban Pesach. Of course, they would slaughter it bein ha'arbaim, in other words, before sunset, actually. But then they had to roast it, and the roasting went into Shabbos, and so it went into Shabbos because it had to be eaten the Beis HaMikdash, and so on. This was a law. But you could not do what? You couldn't take it outside the precincts of the Beis HaMikdash, because that is a no-no, okay? That would be eaten over there. All right. So, at any rate, getting back then to the argument, so he says, look, Rabbi Shimon, your reasoning is terrific. It's marvelous what you can do with the pasuk. But he says, nevertheless, I want to tell you that I could punch holes in it, and still, I admire the subtlety and the brains, the intelligence, so on and so forth. All right. But, that being the case, now let's see whether logic alone, because this was the basis of Rabbi Shimon's argument, that, you know, I can prove logically, right, blah, 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 right? So, can we prove that logically what? Can you say, in other words, that you know, the prohibition is to be derived only on a logical basis? No. As I pointed out, a prohibition should be based upon something in the Torah. And he continues with his argument by saying, even in accordance with an opinion that's given, in this case we had one opinion given a few pages back, Rabbi Yehuda, who felt, you know, that it is permissible to inflict a penalty on the basis of logical reasoning. But even in accordance with that, it says people don't agree with that in general, right? So if that's the case, yeah. So Philo the Madomar Onshim and Adin, that you can inflict punishment simply based on a logical inference from something else, Ain Masirum in Adin. But you cannot tell me that where the Torah never said that there was a prohibition, that you're going to say logically I can imply that there is a prohibition. So that being the case, how can we give Malkus on the basis of all the things that Rabbi Shimon said that you should be getting Malkus for? As, for example, we learned before, what? Well, for example, he says that you get Malkus if, let's say, like Bikurim has to be eaten within Yerushalayim, let's say you take it outside Yerushalayim, Chutz Lachom, right? Get Malkus for that. And you get Malkus, he says, also, if, for example, it is, let's say, a sacrifice, he says, which has to be eaten within the temple courts. That's already going a step further, right? Temple courts. And, you know, you take it outside the temple precincts. Okay? So, you get Malkus for that violation. You get Malkus for a violation if, for example, it is eaten, the Torah says that you have to eat it within the Nimanakloyim, in other words, in the more sacred part of the sanctuary, the Beis HaMikdash, that's where it has to be eaten. Of course, this is only for the Kahanim, because, you know, the ordinary people, you know, they weren't that privileged, all right? And, you know, then let's say you took it out and then you ate even in other parts of the Beis HaMikdash.
What kind of Malkus do you get if you do, if you violate that? I mean,
according to Rav Shimon, you get Malkus.
39
How much? Malkus officially is 39 blows. 39
blows.
Okay,
yeah.
But as we'll learn later on in the chapter, they had to have physicians in order to determine whether a person could actually withstand that.
Yeah.
If he couldn't withstand it, then they gave him less than that.
Less, yeah.
But Rav Shimon is arguing that on the basis of what are the other two things? The other two things is, let's say,
before the recitation,
if it is a sacrifice, right?
Yeah.
And which they are permitted to eat, and they ate it, however, before what?
Before
the blood had been sprinkled on the altar, which is the act of atonement. Okay.
Before they said the necessary invocation.
Yeah, well, that was the original thing that started the whole thing off, namely about Bikurim.
Bikurim, right.
Because there the argument was whether in the case of Bikurim is Kriyo Me'akevis or not, or is it only Hanocha Me'akevis? Kriyo, remember, is the recitation that the person who brings Bikurim before, you know, giving over the basket of the first fruits of the Kohen, he has to express, he has to read the verses of thanksgiving, where he says, Harami Yoveid Ovi, Vayir Mitzrayim, and so on, so just to be said in the Pesach Seder, okay? That's to say, because he's identifying himself as a member of the Jewish people, grateful for the fact that once upon a time we were slaves in Egypt, but God took us out from there, and now he brought us there to Israel, and so therefore in gratitude, behold, I have brought, you know, the first fruits of the ground, of the earth, which you, O God, has given me. Okay? And then, of course, we learned, and then the Nachto, he has to put it down on the altar, and he and the Kohen, they lift it up together, and then the Kohen takes it, and of course the Kohen has to eat it within Yerushalayim, okay? Alright, so there was one more thing that we learned, and that is a prohibition, of course, that even a Kohen who can eat the Holy of Holies and eats it in the the sanctuary, etc., etc., and he ate it even after the blood had been sprinkled upon the altar. But what if it was supposed to be a burnt offering and he ate it? And he gets malchus for that too. Okay? And so therefore, what Rab Shimon was saying is, I can show to you that if a Kohen violated, you know, all these things with one shot,
just by eating the
by eating the carbon. Right, he ate the carbon and he ate it outside Yerushalayim and he ate it outside the Beis HaMikdash and he ate it before the blood had been sprinkled on
and
the altar.
The
so, right. Yeah. So in that particular case, he deserves not one set of malchus, but he deserves five sets of malchus because he violated five different prohibitions. Okay, and this is on the basis of logical reasoning. Okay, so this is the reason why now the next words of the Gemara say. Wait a minute, they say. Yisura bi'alma. No, they say. What Rabbi Shimon is saying over here is only to indicate that this is a wrong thing to do. This is what we mean by Yisura bi'alma. In other words, it's something that should not be done, period. Okay? But he doesn't mean to indicate that he should get malchus for each and every one of these violations because in the final analysis, there's only one prohibition among all these various things that are mentioned. For this again, we have to go back to the pasuk. So let us get our chumashim again and see what the Torah has to say.
There's a big tosfos here.
And how there's a big tosfos, because what they do is they take Rashi and they analyze Rashi and then they go off and they explain why, what, when, where. I mean, if you have all night, I'll go over the Tosfos with you. But, you know, there are times when Tosfos really can be like that.
Yeah.
Obviously, because Tosfos was bothered by this whole business over here. So that's why they expand so much on it.
Yeah.
Right. The rabbi. Okay. The whole thing that got us started as far as this exposition of Rabbi Shimon was, as we said, in Parsha Retei. Okay?
Page 809.
Thank you very much. You memorized it.
What page did you say?
809 or 810. Depends on the
No, actually, it's before.
Before?
Yeah, it's before.
Okay.
Okay, we're in chapter Yud Beis. This is where all this business is. Okay.
Yud Beis.
Right.
Oh, okay. We gotta go back to 805.
Mm-hmm.
804.
Stop back on 801. I'm gonna move you back. Okay. Page 801. Okay.
All right.
All right. Where we saw. That what? The Torah at this point stresses the fact that you have to perform your sacrifices and so on where? Where God's Shekhinah rests, the place which is closest. Naturally, what place is that? That's the base of Migdosh and it's in Yerushalayim, okay? Mm-hmm. So that when we come to verse 6, right, you have to bring over there, Oloseichem, Zivkeichem, right, your burnt offerings, your sacrifices, you know, which are, you know, this is what is shared by the average person together with the Kohanim and so on. But yes, Masroseichem, you have to bring also your Maisers over there, which would include Maiser Rishon, Maiser Sheni, and so on. Although, actually, that's not so. But Maiser Sheni, this we learn. That definitely, because that's what we read, for example, in Aser Te Aser, you know, a little bit towards the end of the Parsha over here, that you have to tithe everything that comes. That grows, right? And then what do? You have to take it to the place which God has chosen, which of course, you know, means the Beis HaMikdash, right? And there you have to eat it. Okay. So you have to bring your maasers over there, the Yesh Trumas Yedchem. In other words, the this is what they call Nidorim and Nidobos. In other words, things that you were promised to give, you know, that you want to make a donation of the sacrifice to the Beis HaMikdash. And that's the next thing over there, Nidrechem, Nidvesechem. Tzonchem, and this is the Bechor, you know, the firstborn animal, which also had to be brought to the Beis HaMikdosh, and it was the was consumed by the Kahanim over there. And it says, "V'achaltem sholfnei Hashem lekeichem, asmachtem b'chol b'shlach yechem adu b'chem Hashem baruch Hashem akam." Okay, so far so good. So this is what he says. Okay, and then it's repeated again on the following page, right? Again, take a look, for example, in verse 11, right, where it speaks about the importance of the place where God chooses to cause His divine name to rest there on, to bring over there, right? Which is a repeat again of what we had before.
Why repeat?
Right? If the Torah repeats, it has a good reason.
That's what I say. Why?
Right. The answer is that it may be simply that the first one is a general statement and the second one is more specific, that don't forget you got to do this okay, that's one possibility. Okay, and then after that again take a look at verse 17, right? Lo sechal echol b'shorechem as hadegoncho terosho etzorecho as b'chol etzanecho b'chol derecho shen do no tzel 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 tzel. All these things we mentioned before, kim atlei ad Hashem adakecha toch lenu, right? You have to eat it b'boka m'shevcha Hashem ato vincho b'techa avdecho ma'asecha alev yeshe b'sharecho, and rejoice over there. Okay, and also not only that, don't forget the poor. Yishomer l'cho pen ta'azo b'shalevi. In this case, why is the Levi poor? Levi is poor, he doesn't have land. Okay, remember that. We said that the Levim, Nebuch, they were deprived of land in Eretz Israel.
Why were they deprived of land?
Because the Torah wants them to be the teachers of the people of Israel, and so therefore, instead of having, you know, land of their own, with one exception, I'll come back to the second, okay. But in general, they wanted the Levim to be scattered among all the various tribes so that they could serve as spiritual guides to the people. And of course, the Levim also had a function in the Beis HaMikdash as well. All right. When I say that the Torah says that they're not to have any land, but it does create cities, if you remember, where the Levim lived. Okay? And we've had that earlier in connection with Elohim HaGoylin, you know, the people who go into exile, that they constituted also, the Orei Halavim constituted cities of refuge as well for the Rotzeach, for the person who murdered accidentally. Yeah. Okay, so getting back over here, so the Gemara concludes at this particular point that as far as Rav Shimon is concerned, alright, he's not actually saying that you have to get malchus for each and every one, although that may be his private opinion. But it is Isura B'Alma, right? To tell you that these things are, it's not right to do this and the other, but not necessarily to imply that the punishment for any of the violations mentioned over here is going to be malchus. Okay? So naturally they're going to object to that too. Okay? But they say, look, didn't Rava say as follows? He says, Zor she'ochal min ha'olah lepnei zvika, if somebody who is not a Kohen ate of an olah, right? He ate what was supposed to be a burnt offering, lepnei zvika. In other words, presumably the animal had been geshocht, presumably. But he grabbed the animal, and what did he do? He started to eat it even before they sprinkled the blood and before, you know, they burnt the olah. Okay? So, we would say this is a horrible thing that he did, and therefore, you know, he deserves the punishment of Malchus for doing it. But, says Rabbi, right, if he did that, right, so Shochem and Oyle Lefnei Zrika Chutz Lachonra, but where did he eat it? He ate it outside of Yerushalayim, in other words, not in the precincts of the Beis HaMikdosh. Then in that case, according to Rabbi Shimon, Loke Chamech, right? According to Rabbi Shimon, he deserves five sets of Malchus for all the violations that we mentioned. Outside of Yerushalayim, and outside of Beis HaMikdosh, and he had no business eating it because it was supposed to be an Ola, and so on, and it's like
Five sets would be 5 times 39?
Yeah.
the almost 200 malkas.
Right.
196.
Right, right.
That was in the nature of capital punishment.
Right. Well, maybe they would give him time to recover from one set, and when he was healed, you know, then they bring him in again and sell it, okay?
Well, they're not, he's not getting it yet.
He's
the
not
argument,
getting it
yet. The argument is not finished.
Right. So, what does the Gemara say? So the Gemara says, wait a minute, it says, Hamisha Isurin Hav. What it means to imply, this is of course Robert's interpretation of what Rabbi Shimon is saying, right? According to him, what it means is not that it's a violation of five different lavim, but it means, and therefore he gets Malkus for each and every one of them, but it means only that these are things that he should not have done. But how many sets of Malkus should he get? One.
Just one.
That's all. Why? Because all these things that we mentioned were all subsumed in one pasuk. And what did the pasuk say? It simply says, "Lo suchal le'chol b'sharecha." Right? You're not allowed to eat any place outside of Yerushalayim, any of these things that I've mentioned. Okay? So that therefore, since you violated only one thing that is mentioned in the Torah, then in that case, how many sets of malkas do you deserve? Only one. So this is the reasoning so far. Okay? So we got him off the hook a little bit anyway.
So far he's down to one.
Right. Okay. So now the Gemara says, well, Anan to Anan, hey, wait a minute, they say. Didn't we learn right at the very beginning of the Mishnah, right? And all we have to do is to take a look again to see, you know, that whole listing that we had over there, Elohim Halokin, and so on and so forth, right? Well, we had the, you know, that already we had, right? But a little bit later.
Yeah.
Right, we had another Mishnah. Let's see, where was the other Mishnah?
It was the middle of Yud Zayin.
Middle of Yud Zayin.
Oh,
right. Ho'echa Bikurim, Rad Shalokor Alehem, right? Kodshe Kadoshim Chus Lakloyim, right? If you had Kodshe Kadoshim, you know, outside of the temple precincts of the inner, you know, the most sacred part, or Kochim Kalim, or Maaser Sheni, Chutz Lachoma, we ate these things outside of Yerushalayim, and so on, right? And then they mention some other. All right, but anyway, these three things are mentioned directly in the Mishnah, and what is the implication that you get Malkus for each and every one of these violations, right? So, if the Mishnah says, Vanant Nan Elohim Halokin, right, that he should get Malkus, right, for eating the Kurim or Kosher Kadoshim, you know, outside of the proper place where they should be eaten, as we said. In the case of Bikurim, we said, where did the first fruits have to be eaten? First fruits have to be eaten by the Kohen within the temple itself. This is where he couldn't take it home. He had to eat it within the temple itself, okay? And the same thing is true for Kosher Kadoshim, the Chatos and the Yoshim, that had to be eaten also by him in the temple itself, okay? And then the Kochim Kalim could be eaten within Yerushalayim, just as Maaser Sheni could be eaten within Yerushalayim, okay? But not outside the wall of Yerushalayim. So we learned any violation of these things that are mentioned in the Mishnah, presumably gets Malkus, right? So the Gemara comes now and it says, Ela Kroya Serahu. You know, he says, we have a somewhat redundant sentence. This is what you asked me about before, right?
Right.
That here it mentions it,
why?
And then it mentions it
again?
All over again.
Right.
Same thing, and so on. It says, Michdei Ksiv. Look, it's written, he says. Now here they quoted a pasuk which doesn't exist. No, you have to realize that sometimes the text of the Gemara, either it was based on some oral tradition that somebody had, or simply that they misquoted. It shouldn't happen to us, but you know, even rabbis sometimes misquote, okay? Because the pasuk that we're talking about is actually the Hadesem Shama. So you see on the margin over there, take a look on the right. You see a marginal note?
Yeah.
All right. So it says Sorech Liyot. In other words, you have to really read it as follows. Hadesem Shama, right? And then the next pasuk says V'achaltem Shama Fneyot Shem Lekechem. Okay, this is the right order in which it is. But inasmuch as we see, you know, that they mention the same idea twice, so the Gemara says, no, so, yeah, all right, let me just read the line that we have over there, but I've already told you that we have to make a change up there. Right. Okay. But it should have been the other way. Right? Alright, so that therefore it says, let the Torah simply say, in other words, it gives a list, and then it says after that, and in summary, you're not allowed to eat any of these things. And the understanding is, you're not allowed to eat them outside of the place where they're supposed to be eaten, or on the outside the occasion, etc., etc. Okay? So, so tell me now, why does the Torah have to come again and give me the same listing all over again and say that this is the explanation? Ela, so the Gemara answers as follows, Ela yechudei lehu lave lechol chad v'chad. The reason being to say that there is a negative prohibition for each one of these things that we have mentioned. That's why the summary is there. In other words, it's not one prohibition, but each and every one of these things is a separate prohibition. But what is the implication? Is the implication, therefore, that you should have malchus for each and every one? Or is the implication that one set of malchus is enough to take care of it? Well, this remains to be seen. But the Mishnah itself, as we see, mentioned three different things.
Right.
Yeah. But in the Torah, you know, there are several others that are mentioned as well. So, that being the case, they say gufor. Gufor always means, all right, let's get back to the text that was already cited before. Okay? It's from the word guf, body, but it means let's get back to the body of text or something like that. Okay? You know, learning Gemara, there's a certain vocabulary that you sort of have to acquire as you go along. Okay? So, when you see the word gufor, they're not trying to goof off, but rather they say, "All right, now
don't
we've already made the following statement. Now let's analyze this statement, okay? Goofa.
It's not a corpse, in other words.
Pardon me.
It's not a corpse.
No, it's not a corpse. Right.
Goofa. Goofa is a body.
Yeah, correct.
Body. Goof. Not necessarily a dead one.
No.
Goof is a body.
Right.
Goof. Goofa is usually a corpse.
Really?
Well, but that would be written with a hay at the end.
Yeah,
this is our
right. That's, all right, you can argue that way too. You know, I've seen arguments aside for 2 seconds. Okay, we know how do we say grandfather and grandmother today in Ivrit? We say Saba and Sabta, right?
Sabta, yeah.
Gemara language, of course, would be Sav and Sava. Okay, but this is Aramaic. Now, we say Saba and Sabta. So the question is, okay, Saba, we know you're right. Samach, Bet, Aleph, right?
Yeah.
How about Sabta? How should it be written? So, correctly, we write it with an Aleph because this is an Aramaic word.
Yeah.
And Aramaic, you know, they like to end words with an Aleph. Why? Because actually, the Kamatz Aleph at the end of a word in Aramaic corresponded to Ha, the prefix ha in the Hebrew at the beginning of the word. So really when we say Saba, we're really saying the grandfather, right? And Sapta, we're saying the grandmother. But there are purists who said, look, she's feminine, the Sapta. Let's write it with a hey at the end. So, you know, this reminds me of the argument. Should we write gufa with an olive? Or should we write it with a hey? But here, there's gufa, there's no question what the meaning is. Over here, here it means, all right, so let's get back to the text that we have cited and try to analyze it better. Okay. Gufa ma rava, right? Rava said as follows, right? Zor she'ochal min ha'ola lefnei zriko, right? If somebody who is not a kohen.
That
that's the meaning
that
of the word
stranger,
Zor.
Would that mean stranger?
Yeah, literally means a stranger. But, you know, in the language of the Torah where it says, Vizor lo yochal ki kodesh heim, or something like that, then what it means, right, that there's somebody who's not a Kohen, for example, right?
Yeah.
Or even in connection with the Levim. The Levim had in the Torah, you know, their job was to watch over the Ohel Moed. They had to guard it against who knows what, Ganovim, and whatever it may be, but, you know, they had to make sure, you know, that everything was ship-shaped, and So their job was to be shomrim, you know. But again, it's written over there, v'hazor ha'karev, you know, yomos. In other words, if a person who is not a Levi wants to do the job of a Levi, he's not allowed to do it. I mean, a job is a job. When a kohen is assigned this task to do, he has to do his task. If a Levi is assigned his task, he has to. The Yisrael has no business trying to assume the role of either a kohen or a Levi. Okay. So, Zor, a person who is a non-kohen, right? She'ochal min ha'olo, he ate the olo, even before the blood was sprinkled, right? Lepnei Smikah. Chutz lachoma, and he ate it where? Outside of the city of Yerushalayim. So the Rabbi Shimon, we said, what? Loke chomesh, right?
Five sets
of malchus. So now they say, okay, maybe it shouldn't be five, maybe it should be more than five. Why should it be more than five? Yeah. So he says, but little Kainama, look, maybe you should also get malchus, Nishum Zor Lo Yochal Ki Kodeshim, right? That the stranger is not allowed to eat because it is holy. Okay, of course, the question is, you know, where do we find this particular text? Okay? So the answer is, let's take a chumash. Thank God we still have it over here. And let's take a look towards the Shabbos Choftes. Parsha Tetzaveh. Okay?
Choftes?
Choftes.
Choftes.
Okay, Choftes. Alright. Chapter Choftes, Parsha Tetzaveh, deals with the installation, so to speak, the anointing of the Kohan, right? And so it tells, you know, what they did in order to consecrate them to become Kohan. Okay?
Tetzaveh, yeah.
Right.
Tetzaveh.
And first it tells, you know, about how they had to bring certain sacrifices, like Parben Bokor, right? Elim Shnayim Tamimim and Balechem Matzos. They had to bring, unleavened bread. And then in addition to that, Chalos Matzos, Bidulas Bashemen. In other words, in addition to plain unleavened bread, they also had to bring leavened bread which had been mixed with oil, right? And then Rekike Matzos, Rishuch Makom, these are like thin wafers which are also mixed with oil and so on. They had to bring all these things. And so the Schitim Tasel has to be the finest flour, you know, and so on and so forth. And then after that, you know, together with the sacrifice, and then we read about the various uniforms that they had to wear, the garments that they had to wear for the priesthood and so on and so forth. Okay? And then it deals with what happens after that. And then after that, it says that the Kohanim, now that they have had the Miluyim, in this case the word Miluyim means their consecration. Okay? Today in Israel, if you hear about Miluyim, you know what it means. Yeah. You got to go back for reserve duty in the army. But in the Torah, it had a somewhat different meaning. Okay? So, you know, they have the sacrifice over there. And then, then after that, after they had the sacrifices, it continues. And then it says afterwards, right, take a look on page 347.
Mm-hmm.
Here we have the important pasuk over here. After it says, you know, then it's written, the ochlu osam, and they are to eat them. Right? Asher kupar bohem. In other words, these things, these foods for which atonement has already been made for them. In other words, as we say, what is the atonement? The sprinkling of the blood upon the altar. You see, this affects atonement, right? The malayas yodom the kadesh asam, in order to give them the authority, so to speak, and sanctify them. In other words, to give them the status of being kohanim and holy unto God. The Zor Lo Yochal, here's where we have this, right?
Yeah.
And the non-Kohen, a stranger, he says, shall not eat of these things, Ki Kodeshim, because they are holy. Okay? So this is the pasuk now that they're quoting over here. All right. So, we said before that a Zor, right, somebody who's not a Kohen, and he eats at the Ola outside of Yerushalayim, outside the Beis HaMikdash, etc., 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 he gets five, right?
Right?
So now the argument is that maybe you should get a sixth set of Malkus. Why? Because he has violated another commandment, which says, V'zor lo yochal ki kodeshim, right? It's that the stranger is not allowed to eat because they are holy. So the Gemara says, no, we cannot apply that pasuk over here. Why not? It says, because hane mili, these would apply, it says, heicho de la kohanim chozi. You know, it would apply, the implication is, where the Kohen, it's fit for the Kohen to eat. In other words, if it is, you know, as what we said, you know, the chatos, the oshrim, and so on, you know, the kohanim eat, okay? So, in that case, what happens if a zor eats it? Then in that case, he deserves malchus, right?
Right.
But, hocha, in the case of what? In the case of the ola, where the kohanim name lechose, where even a kohen himself is not allowed to eat an ola, right? So, in that particular case, what? What is the implication? That he does not deserve malchus, because he didn't do something that, you know, only he specifically was told not to do. Everybody is not allowed to eat, including Kahana. So that, therefore, if he ate it, then he can't say, look, you know, you don't give punishment to a kohen. So why should I get punishment for it? Okay? All right. So they bring another pasuk. They say, Belilke name. So maybe he should get punishment for the following thing. Mishum Vosor Basoda Trefo Lo Sechelu. Right? It's a pasuk, of course, in Sefer Shmos, which says that meat, literally in the field, is Trefo. Right? Of course, the English translation is not exactly the way I'm translating it. Okay, the English translation in the Bible over here, if you want to take a look, all right, take a look at chapter 22. Okay? Chof Beis, Shmos.
Chof Beis.
Yep. Correct. It's written over there. What's about sort of trefalo sochelu? Right. First of all, we have this. In a minute, where we find it.
Must be.
In Mishpatim.
Yeah. It should be there. Hello. It's the very end of the chapter
over there, and then it says
the last pasuk over there, the Anshei Kodesh Tiyun Li, says, and you shall be holy people unto me, right, and meat, any flesh that has been torn by beasts, that's how it translates the word trefo, right, in the field, you're not allowed to eat it, and then what? Lakel of Tashlichuno, so you have to throw it to the dogs, right? Ba'yid Tonish Tesla, okay? So
we're talking about Trefo here?
Obviously, he feels that if they're not allowed to eat, then it means that it's Trefo. That would be the supposition.
Yeah, the implication, yeah.
It's Trefo right. Because it was torn by beasts. That's
the literal.
That's the literal. But, yeah.
Okay.
But the purpose here is not that.
Right. But you see, you know, when it comes to a drash, drashes in order to try to bring out a certain point of view that you can derive from the text. That's what a drash is, okay? All right. So he says, Lil Kainami Mishuma Bosabasoda Trefolo Sechelu. Right? And he explains, Kaban Sheyotso Boso Chutzim Chitzo. So, Neesar. Right? This pasuk is interpreted for various reasons. Obviously, reason number one, we understand. If an animal is treif, they're not allowed to eat it. Okay. And therefore, you know, the Mishnah and Gemara and so on goes into an explanation of what is Eilu Treifos, right? this is what makes an animal or a fowl treif and so on and so forth. Okay, so we know, and as I explained to you a couple of weeks ago, technically there's a difference between treifa and nevela, in that treifa today we apply it in the sense that the animal itself, you know, something happened to it in the course of the shechita, whereas the nevela means that to begin with something right, but the words become synonymous.
They become sick animal.
There's something wrong. Exactly, right. Yeah. In other words, a treif, if it has a vital organ, that's diseased or something like that.
Yeah.
Okay. But as I said, in reality, we use the term treif and nevela as synonyms for each other today. Okay. So if that's the case, the pshat says then that they were not allowed to eat treif of meat.
Right.
Okay, good. But why did they have the word basodeh? In the field. So they're looking right to the side, So what is the implication of the fact that it means in the field? So he says, Kevon sheyotza basa chutz lemechitzaso. Once the meat has gone out from the place, that is the locale where it should be eaten,
mm-hmm.
right? Then nesar. Then it becomes prohibited. Now this could have, of course, all kinds of implications. Here he's applying it to the fact that what? If you eat meat outside of its proper place, outside of its proper location, so on and so forth,
then
in that particular case it's straight, right? And you're violating it. And therefore, according to Rava's interpretation, Rabbi Shimon, you should get
Malkus
for it, okay? But as I said, there are many more implications. We have, for example, an implication of something that we call boso shanela nisalim in the wayat, meat, which is without supervision, that already raises a question about it. So that is a problem, okay? But nevertheless, the way things are set up today, where things are under hashgacha and they're prepackaged and everything else and so on, so in that case, the law no longer applies to it. But, in the olden days when you could be shechting and then you didn't know what happened between the time that the shechita took place and the time that you finally got it, this was a very serious problem. In the olden days, for example, part of the, even today, they would, they would slaughter, in the Midwest and then bring the carcass, to the East Coast, to New York, wherever it may be. Well, you had to make sure that the laws of Upkissen were observed. In other words, within 72 hours, you had to make sure that it was washed, it was sprinkled, to make sure that the blood doesn't congeal in there. And so it was a job of Mashgichim, for example, that when the train stopped at a certain locality, and, they had to know the date when it was slaughtered, and, there were tags and the law to indicate, so they had to go and they had to take a pail of water and wash it, or according to others, it was enough, to simply, take a hose and wash it off, and hose it down or something like that. But, this pasuk has various implications depending upon what it is. All right, our implication over here is what? That the minute that meat has gone out of the proper place where it should be eaten, where it should be consumed, then in that particular case, that meat becomes prohibited. So if that's the case, if he ate the Ola and so on, certainly he should be he deserves another set of malchus because of the fact that it had no business being eaten outside of the base of meat. It had no business being eaten, period. Okay, so what is the counter argument to this? So he says, Hani Mele, well, you could apply that Hecho Difnim Kazeh. But okay. In other words, this argument where you say that if it was eaten outside the proper precinct, that would be true if a person ate it outside the precinct when it should have been eaten within the precinct, when it was fit, chazi, in other words, this ra'uy, as we would say in Hebrew today, that it was fit to be eaten within the precincts of the Beis HaMikdash, then in that case, if you ate it outside the Beis HaMikdash and it's supposed to eat it in the Beis HaMikdash, in that case, taki, you deserve what? Malkus. But what about in the case of the Olo where it should not have been eaten in the first place? even within the Beis HaMikdash. So you cannot apply that to the person who waited outside the Beis HaMikdash. So he should not get Malkus on that account. In other words, Malkus has to be for something very, very specific and something that can be applicable. But where it's not applicable, he can't give Malkus. All right, so now he comes with another suggestion. The Lil Kename, maybe he should get Malkus, to Rabbi Eliezer, in accordance with the statement that Rabbi Eliezer made. The Omer Rabbi Eliezer, as Rabbi Eliezer said, Lo Yochal ki Kodesh Hu, or Kodesh Heim, actually. Or Lo Yeochel, actually, is the correct reading. In other words, it's not to be eaten because these things are holy. Okay? And that's in the same chapter that we mentioned over here, in the Chavtes, you know, where we dealt with the Kohanim. Okay? So it should not be eaten. So look, if something is holy and should not be eaten, in this particular case, the holy should not be eaten, so why shouldn't you give him Malkus for that in addition to giving him Malkus for the other things as well, right? And he explains, Kol Sheva Kodesh Hosel Ba'akos Nitein Le'saseh Alatilotso. Wherever something is prohibited, even in the Beis HaMikdash, to tell us that there's a negative prohibition, right? It's an al akilaso, to eat. So in other words, if the ola is prohibited even within the Beis HaMikdash, right? Then in that case, if you eat it, then in that particular case, you deserve, you know, deserve malchus because you are violating a negative commandment. Take a look over here at Rashi, because Rashi gives the classic place for this particular idea. Okay, top of the page over there. Right, says this here, the Nosa. In regards to Nosa, what is written over there says Lo Yeochel, right, Ki Kodeshu. It cannot be eaten because it is holy. Again, what is the definition of Nosa? Noso is, you know, meat of a sacrifice that has been left over when it should have been eaten within the proper time. Correct?
Mm-hmm.
So, what Rabbi Eliezer is saying over here, Rashi continues, he says, Nosan tam ledobon, he gave a reason why he deserves Malkus. He says, Ki kodesh hu, right, because it was holy. And what happened to this holy thing? Shenifsal, it became puzzle. In other words, it became invalid. So, uchmochen, likewise then, kol hakodoshim shenifsalu, all sacrifices that now become invalid, you let it become invalid, and in that particular case, what should happen? You get malchus for that. Well, of course, we learned, however, that this is not necessarily so, because what did we learn about Nosar? It's a classic case for what? The answer is there is an affirmative commandment that tells us what? Vayesh tisrofu. So that makes up for the violation in the negative commandment by giving you an affirmative command on what you can do in order to rectify the situation.
Right.
This is the situation that we refer to as
love.
In other words, a negative commandment which is rectified by the affirmative commandment. Okay. Alright, I'll tell you what, I see it's time for us to be davening mincha right now.
So we can recite the Kaddish L'Rabbanon and
we're now on the Yud Tes. Right,
Amud Beis.
Amud Beis, right.
And
you remember last week, part of the discussion we had towards the end of Daf Yud Tes Amud Aleph is the fact that maybe there are other cases of Malkus besides the one that was mentioned, that if, for example, he ate Ola outside of Yerushalayim before the blood was spilled, etc., 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 then what does he do? He's entitled to how many sets of Malkus? Five of them.
Five.
So now they say, but maybe there's some other violations, maybe you should get another set of Malkus for something else. So, you know, one of them that they suggested, you know, is about Bosabas Tefel, you know, Lo Sechelo, right? Bosabas Tefel, Lo Sechelo. Isn't that a violation? So as soon as the meat, in other words, left where it should have been eaten, in other words, if this was kosher that had to be eaten within Yerushalayim and it went out of Yerushalayim, right? Or if it were even kosher kadoshim, which had to be eaten by the Kohanim within the Beis HaMikdash itself. And let's say they decided that they'll save a little bit, you know, two goes, they say in Shei Joseph. You know, they have these containers over there, plastic containers, which if you eat too much of the meal,
oh,
so
yeah,
you can ask for a to-go.
Oh, to-go. Doggy bags.
We used to call them doggy bags, right? I suppose it doesn't sound as nice as to-go. So let's say the Kohen decided that, you know, he had enough in the Beis HaMikdash, but he wanted to take home a little bit of something, the nash over there. The minute he does that, there is Malkus, because it's Bosa B'chus L'mchitzaso, right? So they say, well, you know, there are cases where you have to go as to whether to begin with, was it a violation or was it not a violation, okay? So we've spoken about that. We've spoken about Nosor, as we saw, where in accordance with the opinion of Rabbi Eliezer, the guy actually deserves Malkus because the food was Kodesh, it was holy,
and
he let it become Nosor. He let it become. So therefore, you should get Malkus for that. But as we repeated on many occasions, doesn't get Malkus for it because, in accordance with the view of the Chachamim, he can rectify it, right? There's a lav had interklase by virtue of the fact that he burns the Nosor, and that's it. Okay. Fine. So now they're trying to establish another one, okay? Yeah. All right, let's start from the top again. It says, all right, Kol Shema Kodesh Pasul, right?
Yeah.
We learned in the Mishnah, you know, that anything that he eats, if he eats Kodesh in a state of tumor, or if he ate it outside where it should be eaten, and so on and so forth, then he deserves Malkus for that, right? So, Ba'a Kosul Detain Le Sase Laki Lasa. So, the Pasig comes in order to tell us that, you know, it's virtually like saying, you know, thou shalt not eat. Well, if this is a violation of a law, then as we see, then in that case he deserves Malkus for violating the law. Again, we've established before, you know, that when can a person get Malkus, when should a person get Malkus, if he violates a negative commandment. And we also learned, by the way, it's a negative commandment in which there is also an action taking place. But if it's a negative commandment where there is no action, as we saw, for example, remember we had the case way, way back about the Ones Mufata, right? I mean, the guy, you know, who either he committed rape or he seduced and so on,
right,
and so forth, right? And, you know, he deserves, I mean, he has to pay a fine, there's no question for that. But the question is, does he also get Malkus for that? Because we did establish that there is another guy who gets it, and that is the Motzi Shemrah. Because there, the Torah inflicts an additional punishment, because it wants to make sure, remember that we learned, I told you that this would be the basic idea of the onshu also, that there is an onish, not just the fact that he has to pay Meor Kesef in that case, but also that the Torah feels that it's a very heinous thing to go and to tell people that my wife was not a virgin when I married her. You're trying to destroy her reputation. And it's a heinous crime, and therefore, if it's false, then you deserve Malkus in addition to paying a penalty. Okay? So, but the other case, the Yonis Mufata, right, he wanted to divorce his wife, and he didn't like her afterwards, so he said, you know, he has to keep her, right? But by virtue of the fact that he remarries her, so he gets out of Malkus. So we see that there are other cases, you know, we already discussed previously of Lav Anita Glase. Okay. So he's suggesting the same thing over here. Right? He's saying that you know, there is a loisase involved in, you know, the eating nosa, right? So he says, Hani Mila Hecha de Kodem Pesule Chazik, right? This is true where in a case where before he violated by eating, right, before it became pasul, it was fit for eating. As for example, the sacrifice was okay, but he says, Hocha. Now, right now we're talking about the Kodem Pesulei Namelei Chazer. Let's say Trefa meat, right? Where he should get Malkus for eating, but he doesn't get Malkus for it. Why not? Doesn't get Malkus for it because it was never right to begin with. So, that particular case, right, he'll get a couple of other punishments, but he doesn't necessarily have to get Malkus for that. Okay, figure out some other things. Vililka. So, how about another case where we suggest that you get Malkus? Vililka Nami, all right, why don't we also, assess him that he should be penalized for Malkus? To Edoch the Rabbi Eliezer, in accordance with another opinion stated by Rabbi Eliezer. The Tanya, as we learned, this is Gemara in Menachos, where it says, Rabbi Eliezer Omer, Rabbi Eliezer says, Kol Shehu Bechlil, or Kolil, actually, is the way I should read it, Kol Shehu Bechlil, Tiyah, Bechlil Tiyah, that's what the Pasuk says, Kolil Tiyah, then in that case, Litain Lo Sa'aseh Alachi Lo Sal. Alright, what is he saying over here? Says, look, the Torah specifies concerning certain sacrifices that it has to be kolil tiyah. What does kolil tiyah mean? Kolil tiyah means that it has to be completely consumed in fire. Okay? As for example, we said the ola has to be kolil tiyah. Okay? But in reality, the pasuk deals in the original not with this, it deals with another aspect. We're dealing over there with something else, and that's the Minchas Kohen. Okay? Good evening. How are you? Rabbi Gemara. Torah says, okay, first of all, we have to define what is the word Mincha. Okay? Mincha means, literally, a flower offering. Okay? Of course, we use it in a different sense today. They were already using it in that sense too in the time of the Gemara as well, as we saw, But in the Torah, the word mincha has this particularly, it's a specialized meaning. It also means, in general, a gift that you present, mincha, okay? But in the specialized use in which the Torah has it, it refers to a korban, which which represents a mixture of flour and usually oil. Okay, it's what we say, for example, every Shabbos. Solas belulav hashemen, right? In other words, solas is fine flour, belulav hashemen, right? Which is mixed with olive oil, right? And then, of course, the nisko, this refers to the libation of pouring wine on the altar also, okay? So, this is what the mincha is, okay? Now, the average person, if he would bring a korban mincha, normally, what would happen is that part of it would be burnt on the altar. Okay? This is what they call in the Torah askorasa. In other words, literally the memory part of it or something like that. It's one of these difficult terms, when it comes. But this is what they refer to it, okay? And in some of the menachos, which is the plural of the word mincha, the Kohen also had to add Livona, which is frankincense, to put it on top over there. And, that would burn together with it. And then it's written over there, V'hanoseris b'meno, right? Whatever is left over of it, after you've burned part of it on the altar, Li'aron uvanov, right? It belongs to the Kohanim, in other words, and so on. But what happens if a Kohen wants to himself give a mincha as a sacrifice, a donation? Okay, so the answer is, in that case, it's written over there, V'chol minchas kohen kolil tiyeh, it says kolil toktor, right, or kolil tiyeh, right? In other words, it has to be burnt completely. Okay. So this is what they're referring over here in the Mincha right now. Okay? He's saying over here that, look, he should get Malkus for something else. It's written, Koshu b'kolil tiyeh, wherever something has to be burned completely, then detain lo sasa ala filoso. Then in that case, we have to infer that there is a negative commandment concerning its eating. Even if the Torah wouldn't actually say the words that it shall not be eaten. I mean, we do find the expression, lo yochel, okay? But even if it didn't say that, we would be able to infer that if you have an affirmative command, which obviously has a negative, you know, the converse is negative, then in that case it counts as if it were a lo saseh. You understand what I'm saying?
You convert it from
right.
Positive
Torah
to
says it is exactly. Torah says it shall be completely consumed in fire. Okay? So, what is the implication? The implication is that if it is not completely consumed in fire, but instead eaten by the Kohen eats it when he had no business eating of it, then in that particular case, even though it doesn't say that he's not allowed to eat it, but nevertheless, the inference is that if he violates the positive commandment of Kolil Tiyeh, then in that case, it is as if he had violated a negative command in eating what he wasn't supposed to. Okay? So, in that case, what therefore does Rabbi Eliezer imply? Rabbi Eliezer is implying, therefore, that he performed an action for something which was a negative commandment which he violated, and therefore what should he get? Malkus. Okay? That's why it says Malilka. Yes. I would say definitely yes, because of the fact that
it was supposed to be burned completely.
Kodesh, you have to treat it in the sense of holiness, so that you don't take anything like that and, you know, you simply throw it in the garbage.
So,
in
other words, any other thing that he does with it except for burning it.
Right.
It's a lob on that.
Absolutely.
Whatever
right.
He does.
Right. Well, certainly, throwing in the garbage is not the thing. Certain times, what they did do is to, let's say, to bury something. Let's say a sacrifice that they had sacrificed, they discovered that there was a woman in it, okay?
Well, then it was disqualified.
So obviously,
anyway.
Right, it was disqualified, okay? But what are you going to do with the animal? You can't burn it on the altar because it has a woman, you understand? So in that case, what did they have to do? They had to take the animal and bury it, okay?
Yeah, but that's outside this argument, though.
Yeah, right. But I'm only pointing out, you know, because what Rona said, you know, throw it in the garbage. Something which is holy, you don't throw in the garbage.
No, I'm aware of something.
Right.
Saying what, you know, it's not just the Hakilah that forbids
it. Right. Same thing would be true. Right.
Under the same.
Absolutely. And of course, the whole idea of notar or nosar, or whatever you want to call it, is the fact that it has to be burnt. By Eish Tisrofa.
So that's the first law.
Because that's the only way, right. It's the only way.
The first law.
Exactly.
What so, after that is added Malkus.
Right. So he says, yes,
because
okay.
Haven't we learned that the onish only comes from the deen that's explicitly stated? And here,
yeah.
We're arriving at an inference. I mean, this is a logical inference. That
you,
we're
yeah, what you're saying is 100% right. And therefore, there's going to be disagreement about these various points over here. In other words, they don't necessarily say that everything that is being said over here is right.
This is
according
to Rabbi Eliezer. Huh? This is Rabbi Eliezer,
right. But take a look at the next three words. You know what it says over there?
You can know.
It says, in Hachinami. You know what Hachinami means? Taka Azoi. In this case, the Gemara agrees with his point of view. That actually in this particular instance he has violated a negative commandment, even though it's only inferred and it's not stated specifically. Okay, so there are cases like that, but what you say is normally correct. because we've been learning over here that you need an azhara. You have to have an explicit warning telling us that this is wrong, and then you have to have an oinesh, which tells us, you know, and what would be the punishment for the violation of it. And if we have only an azhara and we don't have an oinesh, then you cannot inflict the oinesh. This is the general proposition. Okay, so now they continue the discussion. The Rava, who obviously disagrees, but these are all great, great sages. They didn't always see eye to eye upon these minutiae of Jewish law, correct? So the Rava Mahai Krokova. So the Rava derives this kind of a, you know, the fact that you deserve Balkis or something like that from this pasuk. Amarav Gidl. In other words, Rava would be in agreement with this last statement that we had of Rabbi Eliezer, namely that the implication is over there that, you know, if there's a violation of Kalil Tiyev, then in that case the Aseh implies a Los Aseh. Okay, so now we come to another statement. Amarav Gidl Amarav. And he says, Kohen she'ochal mechatos ve'osham l'pnei zirika lokem. Okay? If a Kohen eats either the flesh of the chatos or the osham before the blood has been sprinkled on the altar, of course, this is similar to what we've had before, right? Then he says, lokem, he gets malchus, right? And he says, my tama. What is the reason? Why should he get malchus? Says the Omar Kor, because the Pasuk says, the Ochlu Osam Asher Kupar Bohem. Literally, that the Kanim are to eat them. This is in the case of the Miluyim, you know, when they were being instructed as to how to be inducted into the Kohuna, okay? And so they had sacrifices. In the case of the Chatos, they had to eat it, right? So it says, the Ochlu Osam, they are to eat them. Asher kupar bohem, for which atonement has been made. Okay? In other words, what is the implication of Asher kupar bohem? It says the acha kapora, after atonement has been made. And what is, of course, the atonement? This we learned before already, that the atonement of the sacrifice, that part consists of the sirika, of the the sprinkling of blood upon the Mizbeach. Okay? So, it says, the Acha Kapora in other words, after the atonement has been made, yes. But if they Kapora, lo. But if they eat it before, then in that case, no. And he says, Lav Habo Miklal Asei Lavu. In other words, based on this pasuk, he derives a similar principle that we discussed just a few moments, namely what? That a negative command, which we can infer from an affirmative command, is a negative command. Masiv Rava. So Rava has the following kasha. It says, V'chol behemu mafresas parso, v'shosa shesa shtei forasos, Malaz Gira Babahemo Oso Tochemo. Okay? This pasuk, I'm sure that you're all familiar. Mm-hmm. It says that every domestic animal, that's what a behema is, right? Which is Mafresa's parcel. Of course, in reality, the law applies also to what we would call a Chayak Shera. A deer, for example. If you decided that you're in the mood for deer, since it's a kosher animal, mm-hmm. It has split hooves, choose a cud, and so on. So, you know, if you're shafted, you can do it. As a matter of fact, in New York, now they have a couple of restaurants which cater to the people with fancy tastes. If they want to know what venison tastes like, you can eat venison in such a restaurant.
Kosher.
Kosher.
Yes, kosher.
Yeah, glot kosher. Glot kosher venison. Right?
Really?
Yeah, yeah. I'm not kidding about that.
Amazing how they catch a lion or a shepherd.
Yeah, well, obviously they would have to domesticate.
No, they raise it. They raise it.
They were domesticated. That's the answer.
It's possible maybe a ketchup, but the snares they usually
use. Yeah. Yeah, it is possible. I mean, if you make a fence around it or something, catch it within the fence or something like that, you know. And, you know, the animal itself remains unharmed physically. Because, you know, if Chas v'Shalom, a leg was broken or something like that, then you already have questions about whether it can be a kosher animal, you understand? But if it was caught, you know, without any damage done to the animal itself, and you have a sheikhet who's willing to try shechting it and so on, then in that case, you know, the same as any other animal, okay? Torah does make a distinction, however, between a chaya and the behema in one respect. In respect to what we call kisui hadam, which means that the blood of the animal has to be covered over. This applies to a chaya and it applies to an oaf.
What? Just
oaf. Fowl. In other words, fowl. This is why, I don't know how they work it in the empire with it, doing thousands of chickens around the clock, you know. But in the old fashioned days, you know, when you had a sheikhet, you would bring him a chicken in order to shech. He would sheft it and then he had to drain blood, and the blood that spilled on the floor and so on, he had to cover it up. Cover it up with sawdust, with straw, with regular dust, you know, that you have to cover, but you have to cover the dust, okay? So that applies to the chaya as well. So if you would slaughter a deer, you have to cover the blood. But it does not apply to a behema, because the word behema is not mentioned over there. All right, anyway. The pasuk tells us that every beast, ma'preses parso, v'shotah shashay poses, right? In other words, it has a cleft in the hoof, right? And as a result, you see, you know, two sides to the hoof, as a result of the cleft. And ma'alatz gerot, also at the same time, it has to chew a cud, right? Ba'behema, right? Oso tochelo, this you may eat. Now, this is what? This is an affirmative commandment, right? Oso tochelo. I guess the vegetarians don't hold that this is an affirmative commandment. But this is an affirmative command the way that it's correct. Okay. So, how is this interpreted? It's interpreted, Oso tochelo, this you may eat, right? But you're not allowed to eat any other animal. In other words, one which does not have these simonim, as we would say, right? These characteristics. They eat the kohamret. And if it is the way you are arguing, he says, then why ezeh lo socheilu lomoli? Then why does the Torah have to go on and mention after it says, you know, that this you may eat, and then following it with a negative commandment? Couldn't we already infer from the fact that the Torah says, this alone you can eat, but you can't eat anything that doesn't muster up to it? So why does the pasuk then have to come and say, right, right? Ella, but he says, if you're learning, learn the tradition in the following manner. In other words, don't follow the what we just said over here, but reinterpret it differently. Okay. Omar Rav Gidl, that Rav Gidl said the name of Rav, he says, Zor she'ochal mechatos ve'osham of Nezriko, Potter. Says, the person is a non-Kohen. Okay? Remember, that's the way we translate the word Zor. Person is a non-Kohen, and he ate either from the Chatos or from the Osham. The Chatos, remember, the sin offering, the Osham, the trespass offering. Lifnei Zbriko, even before the blood was sprinkled on the altar. Potter, he's Potter. Not sure, what is he Potter from? He's Potter from Malkus. Okay? Had no business doing it, because who alone is allowed to eat Chatos and Osham? Only a Kohen. And here, somebody is not a Kohen, he comes and he eats of it. But when does he eat of it? Before the before it was sprinkled on the altar, right? Before the kapara, right? So it's potter. My tama, what is the reason? Why should it be potter? So he says, go omar kro, because the pasuk says, we ochlu osam asher kupar bahim, right? That they are to eat them where atonement has been effected. Kol hecho de kaminin baby ochlu osam, wherever the Torah says that they may eat them, right? Upon which, for which, you know, after atonement has been made over them. So, Karin and Bey, Vizola Yechal Kodesh. There we apply the pasuk that Azor is not allowed to eat because it is holy. In other words, at what point did the Chatos or the Oshem become holy? This is the question. You understand? At what point did it become holy? Was it when it was Geshochten? No, that wasn't enough. It became holy when the sprinkling of the blood was made for atonement on the altar. Okay? Then it becomes holy. At that point, if the Zor should eat it, then in that case, he deserves Malkus. Okay? But the Chol Heicha, the Lo Karin and Bei, the Ochlo Osam Asher Kapar Bahem, Lo Karin and Bei, the Zor Lo Yochal. But wherever we do not apply the verse concerning the particular situation that, you know, they may eat them when atonement has been effected for them, then we cannot apply the ruling that Bezor Lo Yochal either. We have to be consistent, he says. So Omar Rabbi Loza, Omar Rabbi Shaya, Rabbi Loza said, in the name of Rabbi Shaya, says, and this comes back to something that we had earlier about the Bikurim, okay? He says, Bikurim, he says, remember the business about Bikurim, he says, Hanochan Akevis Bahem, Kriyoim Akevis Bahem. Alright, so Rabbi Loza comes and he quotes Rabbi Shaya to say that in the case of Bikurim, it's the Hanocha which, if it was not fulfilled, it would invalidate it. Now, what did we say the Hanocha is? Hanocha means that you have to put the basket down before the coin on the altar, right? So this is the Hanocha. So it says, if that was not done at the time when we brought the Bikurim, then in that case, the action is invalidated, right? But Kriya, in other words, simply to recite the Psukim, Arami Ovidovi, Vayir Mitzrayim, etc., etc., Vayotzir Lashem Mitzrayim, you know. So that, if he failed to recite the Psukim, this would not invalidate it. This, of course, needless to say, is contrary to what we learned in the Mishnah. Because what did the Mishnah say? If he ate Bikurim, that is, if the Kohen ate the Bikurim, Lifnei Kriya, Lifnei Kriya, right, before the actual recitation of the verses, then in that case he deserves Malkus, that Kohen. Okay? So here we see that Rabbi Hoshaya disagrees with that point of view, and he says that on the contrary, he says, Hanocha is Ma'akevis, but not the recital of the verses, not the Kriya. So the Gemara immediately challenges and says, Rabbi Eloza, did Rabbi Eloza really say that? But Omar Rabbi Eloza, Omar Rabbi Hoshaya, didn't he say as follows? Hifrish Bikurim Kodim Lachag. If a man had set aside first fruits prior to the festival, but which festival? Chag always in the Gemara means by itself, it means the festival of Sukkot. Okay. So that means that we got to consider again, take a moment for the background of this, okay? The Mishnah in Maseches Bikurim describes how people have to bring Bikurim. I mean, this we know, the Torah tells us that they have to bring Bikurim, right? Put in the basket and everything else and so on. Very beautiful ceremony, you know, people march to Yerushalayim and so on and so forth. The earliest time to bring Bikurim to the Beis HaMikdash was, of course, Chag HaShavuos, okay? Because that is called in the Torah, right? Of Yom HaBikurim, that's what it says, on the day of the first fruits, right? B'hakrivchem mincha chadosh al Hashem, when you sacrifice, you know, a new offering unto God, b'shavuos seichem, and the festival of Shavuos, right? So mikro kodesh yelachem, etc., etc. Okay, so the sacred festival unto God. So Shavuos is the earliest time that a person could bring Bikurim, but naturally he would begin to set aside what he's going to bring as Bikurim prior to that. That's based upon when he notices, you know, that the first fruits are forming. When the first fruits are forming, so the Mishnah Bikurim tells us that he has to tie a thread around it. Something that he would remember that this was the first, right, the marker, that this was the first fruit that he saw growing on the tree. Because he cannot bring first fruits from fruits that were not first fruits. It stands to reason. Yeah. So he had a mark. If he had 2, 3, 4, 5 trees and so it was only the first fruits, you know. That he, and then, of course, he afterwards, when they ripened sufficiently that they were of good quality to bring to Yerushalayim, that's when he would make his pilgrimage. So the earliest fruits in Eretz Yisrael would be ready prior to Shavuos. But not all fruits, as we know. Fruits have different seasons for becoming ripe. So in that case, he could bring it any time, beginning with the festival of Shavuos, right up to the festival of Sukkos. Okay? And then the Mishnah says also that for under certain circumstances he could bring it even after Sukkos until Chanukah. But it makes a big differentiation, the Mishnah, between bringing and reciting, right, and bringing and not reciting Arami Odeilavi. Okay? The ideal situation is, of course, bringing and being able to recite, okay? If he would bring it sometime between Pesach and Sukkos, this is the time of the year when it's written, Misomachto bechol hatov. You are to rejoice in all the goodness which God has given unto you, because after all, a harvest of the fruit of the soil that you yourself have tended and, you know, worked at it, and now you're ready to enjoy the fruits, so this is the time, okay? But if it would be brought after Sukkos, then in that particular case, he brings it, but he does not recite anymore because it's already post-season, so to speak, okay? It's no longer the idea of a Samach to Bechol HaTov. Why not? Because, you know, once Sukkos is over, we see the days getting short, the weather getting colder, and everything else. It's been so long, it's such a joyous season. Mm-hmm. And in Eretz Yisrael, of course, hopefully they have rain beginning about that time, and so on. So, if you experience rain in Eretz Yisrael, you know it could be pretty cold. Especially if you go during January, February, and it rains at that time, then you really feel it.
Yeah. It's a joyous celebration, and that probably wouldn't bring us there in 3 weeks.
I have to tell you, as long as the Beis HaMikdash was in existence, you didn't have to worry about three weeks.
Right.
I mean, these are days of mourning to us because of the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash.
You have to worry in the second temple about Tisha B'Av.
Not necessarily so. The average opinion is that Tisha B'Av was not observed in the days of the second temple. Because
everybody knew it happened, you know, Tisha B'Av was...
Yeah, all right, I understand, but don't forget, in the days of the Second Temple, what had happened in the days of the First Temple was, shall we say, made up for by the fact that they had rebuilt the Beis HaMikdash and so on and so forth. So, as a result, it cancelled out that.
They didn't think about the things.
Right. You have to bear in mind, that naturally, there are psukim, you know, to account for these things too, okay? There's a pasuk in the Tanakh where he says that Tzom Horavii v'Tzom HaChamishi, right? V'Tzom HaAsiri Actually, it also includes Chol Ma'ashvi, I guess, over there too. It's Chol Ma'asiri. He says, Yulavesh Yisrael, Lesoson Ulesimcha. These will become days of rejoicing. Okay? So, what is the Tzom Horevi? The fast of the fourth month, that's the Shivasa Batamas. Okay? Tzom HaChamishi, the fifth month, that is, of course, is Tisha B'Av. Tzom HaShvi'i, this is not Yom Kippur. Yom Kippur was observed as a day of fasting in the Beis HaMikdash because the Torah commands it. You understand? But, Tzom Gedalia, exactly, which was also a day of disaster connected with the destruction of the first Beis HaMikdash, okay? And finally, of course, Tzom HaAsiri, which was Asar B'Tevis, first day of the temple.
Was the first temple or the second temple?
At the end of the first temple. Temple was destroyed. But the Babylonian king, Nebuchadnezzar, permitted a Jewish group to remain in the land. He didn't exile everybody, okay? And he appointed a governor. And the governor was Gedaliah ben Achikam, okay? And, you know, the Jews might have had an opportunity to rebuild their own life even after the Churban at that particular time when, unfortunately, he was assassinated. He was assassinated by conspirators and, you know, some of these conspirators like Sambalat and others and so on. Some were Jews who were jealous of him, who wanted to seize the government themselves. And others were, you know, from the neighboring peoples who were willing to stir up trouble. So at any rate, with the death of Gedaliah, the Jewish community in Eretz Yisrael lost heart and they decided there was no hope for them. And they ran off. A lot of them ran off to Egypt. They schlepped Yirmiyahu together with them over there so that he died over there in exile. Okay? So that was the story. I mean, this is why the Gemara comes and says that the death of Gedaliah is as tragic to us as the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, because it was the destruction of the whatever hope there was for a Jewish community in Eretz Israel after the destruction of the first temple. So that's why we fast, unless you follow the system that says, you know, the old joke, they ask somebody, why doesn't he fast on some Gedaliah? So he said, tell me, would Gedaliah fast for me? So that's why he didn't want to fast on some Gedaliah.
Sounds like a socialist.
Wasn't extremist elements more people that were super nationalist back
then? To a certain extent, yeah. Because that was the problem the last days of the first Beis HaMikdash, you know, that Yirmiyahu stood at one end of the spectrum. He believed that the Jews should remain faithful to the pledge that they gave to the Nebuchadnezzar, that they would remain loyal to him, as compared to the war party that prevailed upon Sidkiyahu, the last king of Judah, to rebel. And they were given promises by the Ammonites, the Moabites, and the Egyptians, and everybody said, if you rebel, we'll all join together and we'll fight against Babel. Throw off the yoke of Babylonia. Needless to say, only the Jews did it, and they were left holding the bag, which of course that resulted in the destruction of Yerushalayim, the Beis HaMikdash. The others, they never kept the word.
I wanted to ask, at the time that Gedaliah was assassinated, Masada must have still been in existence, right?
No, the mountain was there, but Masada we associate not with the first Beis HaMikdash.
Oh, sorry, what
second.
Are you talking about?
Right.
Oh, right.
The second one. Yeah.
And that, thank you.
Right.
What am I thinking about?
What?
Also, after the death of Gedaliah, the Babylonians attacked.
The Babylonians didn't attack, the Jews. They attacked before. They destroyed the Beis HaMikdash before it. In 586 BCE, okay, the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed by the Babylonians. But as I said, there was an element, a remnant left in Eretz Israel, and Gedaliah was appointed the governor. And an attempt was made to reconstruct Jewish life over there, to rebuild it, okay? No. That came 70 years afterwards. That came under, after the Persians had conquered the Babylonians, then King Cyrus gave a declaration permitting the Jews to go back, okay?
This was after that all the Jews got
schlepped
to Babylonia, right?
Well, not all Jews were schlepped to Babylonia. As I said, others went to Egypt. Others probably scattered to some of the other coastlands of Asia Minor and so on and so forth. Because even the days of Yeshayahu, I'm talking about, during the days of the first Beis HaMikdash, even before the destruction, he already speaks about, various Galiyot, Jewish settlements, and Iye Hayam, in other words, these would be the islands of the Mediterranean, lands of Hachof, in other words, people in. Besides, there was already an Ashur and a Mitzrayim. Remember, it says, right? V'aho din b'yeres Ashur, v'anidachin b'yeres Mitzrayim, right? Nishtakul Hashem HaKadosh Yerushalayim. He says, they'll all come and back again into Eretz Yisrael. He was an early Zionist. All right. So getting back over here. All right. Question is about Bikurim, right?
Mm-hmm.
All right. So he says, Hifrish Bikurim Kodim Lechag. The Jewish farmer went and he set aside his Bikurim. In other words, he designated that this is going to be my Bikurim, right? And this was prior to when? Prior to Sukkot. Okay? The Yovar Avelein HaChag, and then Sukkot came and went, and yet at the same time, what didn't he do?
He didn't bring it.
He didn't bring his Bikurim to the Beis HaMikdash. So, what should happen with these fruits? Let's say he comes then after Sukkot, he brings a basket of fruits to the Kohen, and what is the Kohen supposed to do with it? So the answer is, you're kavu. They have to run away. They cannot be eaten. So, my love, why can't we say that the reason is Mishum de la Motze de Mikra Elehen? The reason is because he can no longer recite the Arami Ovid Ovi concerning these first fruits. Because remember what I said before, that after Sukkot, although you bring, but you don't recite,